Hey, it's episode 423 of the 343 podcast. Today, I have a guest. His name is Rory O'Neill, a 14-year veteran here in the United States coaching youth soccer. He knows his stuff very deeply. It's one of my favorite episodes of all time. Yes, of all time. He dives into tryouts because, as we all know here in the United States, it is tryout season. It's been tryout season. It continues to be tryout season. The ins and outs, you're going to get a lot of insight there. And of course, we dabble into why things are the way they are here in the United States soccer ecosystem. He has a lot of knowledge. Here we go. Speaking of having a lot of knowledge and being here in the American soccer ecosystem as a coach, coaches, you need to go to 343coaching.com. I am serious, dead ass serious. There are free and premium programs for you there. The sooner you can get on the premium program, the better off you are going to be, the better off your teams are going to be, the better off your players are going to be. Your career trajectory will take off, as shown by thousands of testimonials that I've received over the course of its foundation, which was 2013, mind you. Man, time flies. It's been 12, almost 13 years since the original launch of the premium program. And parents, we don't forget about you. You need to mentor and coach your kids also. For you, we've developed an entire product from scratch from our decades worth of experience in the American soccer ecosystem. You go to 343masterclass.com. And finally, if you're coaching in the 7-versus-7 environment, you go to 7v7coaching.com. All right, everybody, I hope you enjoy this episode with Rory O'Neill. Here we go.
How's everything on your end?
Yeah, no, everything is great, dude. Everything is very good. I'm a little bit out of shape, so I wish I need to get back into my running routine. But other than that, man, yeah, everything is good. The soccer stuff is good. I'm bringing Benny along quite nicely. He is helping out quite a bit. I've been doing the best I can to let go of a lot of things, but as I'm sure you know, Rory, it's hard to step away, right? And fully entrust others to just run with it.
Yeah. I mean, he's doing a nice job. I mean, there's very frequent, you know, social media posts, and that, I know that's one of the challenges for me on the YouTube side, because I don't have anybody who helps me. So it's like, people are like, why don't you post more shorts? Why don't you post on Instagram? Why don't you post on X? And I'm like, well, I don't have 5 hours a day to do this. So, you know, that's the challenge. And as you know, the more you post and the more you put your opinion out there, the more the machine and the algorithm seems to pick it up and the more viewers that you get. And it's just, it's a game, you know?
Yeah, but you're a monster, Rory. You're killing it on YouTube. And maybe that's helped you too, is just focusing, because it seems like you focus on that platform.
Yeah, it's really the only platform I use. I mean, I had an Instagram account for the site forever, but I just didn't have enough time and I just kind of let it go. And I feel like the stuff that I try to put out, I try to make it more specific, you know, and it's obviously the stuff that I do is a little bit less of the stuff that we talk about or that you do. It's not really opinion-based. I mean, I guess I shouldn't say that. A lot of it is opinion-based, but a lot of it is just, hey, this is how I would specifically do this in youth soccer. So the audience isn't like, if I were to just, you know, talk about U.S. men's national team, I'd probably get more views, you know, just because the audience is bigger.
Totally. And I think that's the avenue that so many people take, yeah, is talking about the national scene. But yeah, no, Rory, thanks for reaching out, dude. I think you wanted to talk a little bit about winning, right? In youth soccer and that whole
thing. Yeah, well, I originally reached out because, you know, you guys did a great job with Jimmy, and then the follow-up with Benny, just about winning versus development. But I wouldn't mind, just because it's top of mind, talking about the worst week in youth soccer calendar that all of us, that I went through last week, I guess I should say, but it happens all across the country. And I feel like there's so many parallels to the things that you talk about all the time across the board. And this specific issue of tryouts is just so fresh in my mind. I'm almost recovering from the week that I've had, to be honest with you.
No, I would love to hear that, because as you know, I've been out of that world for such a long period of time. And I know the audience reaches out to me once in a while. Hey, Gary, what do you do for tryouts? Or hey, Gary, what do you do for X, Y, or Z? And I'm like, guys, it's been 6 years since I've touched youth soccer and got my hands dirty. So they're hungry for this, Rory. And I want to hear from your experience as well, this whole tryout situation. It seems very hectic, from what I can gather. And it seems that at the end of the day, nobody's happy. I don't know. No, like, it seems like a big mess.
Yeah, it's a huge mess. And, you know, this goes back to the ecosystem that we are a part of. And so, you know, when I say I'm recovering, I really think about it kind of in two camps. You know, it's really tough to give 10, 11, 12 year olds hard news. And that's what I've had to do for the last week, you know, and part of it is a consequence of, let's say, the popularity of a program or a coach that you're at. So currently I coach the first and second U12 teams at the club that I'm at. So we are moving into U13. And so, and with that, I'm actually going to be coaching the U13 MLS next team. So we had, 150 kids come out. And, you know, at the end of the day, you have to give kids bad news. So that's one piece of it. You know, there are parents who don't necessarily understand what's happening, who aren't keyed in, who don't know soccer, who don't, you know, have an understanding of why you're giving their player a particular grade or particular rank and stuff like that. And the flip side of that is that, you know, I think some of it is how do you teach kids to deal with adversity and what's the response to that? But that aside, so there's a small part of me that has that, but that's every year. The bigger part of me is really the anger and the resentment that I have towards the system that we're in and how that has cultivated the tryout process to be what it is today. So what I mean by that is clubs are incentivized primarily for customer retention, primarily. Now, there are some clubs doing really good things. I think the club I'm at is doing some really good things. There are coaches here and there who develop players who really have an altruistic view of development and all of that. But, and I want to just preface this, I don't blame the clubs for acting like this. They're a business that's acting in an ecosystem. But why in the world you're having tryouts in March and April for a team that wouldn't even start to practice in August doesn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense. And clubs will say we have to order uniforms, we have to go through registration, and I get all of that, but that doesn't take 5 months. They're doing that because they have to jockey for position with the other clubs for players. And or at least around my area, and I'm sure it's this way all across the country, we actually have clubs who make offers to players before tryouts even start, like weeks before tryouts even start. They say, okay, you have a spot, just pay your $400 registration fee and you've secured your spot. And so that's just one piece of it. But taking that into account, that's why we have the chaos and how hectic it is, because ideally I would really like to make my decisions on who makes this team at the end of my spring season, when I can see two or three more months of development. Because as you know, Gary, the last person taken on the first team versus the first person taken on the second team typically is not a huge gap. You know, you're making decisions positionally, maybe, or you're saying, okay, who's going to take my set pieces or who's left footed, or very small details for those decisions. But you don't know in two or three months if a kid might make a jump or something might happen. But we're not really looking at this as a tryout for development. We're looking at this as customer retention, in my opinion. And so that's what makes me very frustrated. And so I have to, you know, break kids' hearts and break parents' hearts. And, you know, in many respects, get into arguments with certain parents or things like that based on a system that I have no control over. You know, and I don't think that parents in particular understand, unless they're listening to your podcast, that every single thing that happens in the youth space can be directly tracked back to the ecosystem that we live in. And if US soccer and MLS, which is basically the same thing, really wanted to do something about it, they would. But they don't want to do anything about it. The system is working exactly the way they've constructed. And it comes down to, you know, I mean, Gary, I've talked to coaches this week who are having trouble sleeping, who are, you know, having trouble with health problems, their blood pressure's up. Like, this directly affects, and you know, this affects the parents and the players a lot more than the coaches, but it does weigh heavy on people. I mean, I have so much invested in some of these kids I've been working with for 4 years, and I just had to tell them, hey, listen, I'm sorry, you didn't make the MLS Next top team, you know? And it, so you have the heartbreak of that and sort of the, you know, the, you know, me sort of my feelings and that, but then you have just this whole other piece where I have no control over this animal that is bearing down on me to sort of live in this system. But yet, you know, the coaches for the most part get the majority of the wrath and the blame, and the clubs get the blame, when parents don't see that it actually is, you know, the man behind the curtain who is making all of this, you know, happen.
Yeah. No, there's so much to address there, Rory. First, my heart was going out to you while you're describing all this, clearly very impassioned. And I don't know, I've experienced a lot of things as well from that world and the other world. And the frustration is very real, because I think our hearts are in the right place and we want to do the right thing, and we're not allowed to do the right thing, right? Nobody's there with a gun to your head saying you can't do X, Y, or Z. It's just, this is the nature of the beast, that you have no choice in the matter. So I was writing down a couple of notes. So if you don't mind expanding on a little bit, or at least we can chat about it.
Sure.
I don't know if you've seen Landon Donovan, you know, he just came out with a book and he's making the rounds, right? Marketing rounds, et cetera, like any author would. And he also has this podcast called The Unfiltered Podcast, which he does in conjunction with Tim Howard. And this past week, he's been talking a lot about, or bringing to the forefront, youth soccer and how the quote unquote youth soccer system is in shambles. It's terrible. The kind of like the reason why the national team isn't great is because our youth soccer system is bad. It's because the coaches think that they're Pep Guardiola and they're not doing good work. It's because the youth clubs are money hungry sort of thing. And this whole pointing the finger over and over and over again at the youth, that is where the problem lies. And it's infuriating. I'm not going to lie to you, Rory, because you guys are the problem. Landon, you're part of the problem by diverting all this attention and focusing the angst of the media and the public at large and the parents at the youth, when the top is the issue and everything derives from the top. All the incentives derive from the top because the rules of the ecosystem are made at the top. I won't belabor the point, but I have to get that off my chest because I don't see anybody offering Landon any resistance to what he's saying, right? They're just all kind of accepting it because of who Landon Donovan is. Oh, look, Landon, yeah, hey, join the party, you know? Now that you're a father, you see the things that we've been complaining about all the time. It's a source of frustration for me. And this leads to coach burnout, as you kind of hinted at too, Rory, because you try to do good work, the system beats you down, and then you want to quit. Maybe you can make some remarks on that, but I also wanted, for the audience's sake and for the coach's sake in our audience, at some point in our discussion, for you to kind of lay out how you ran your tryouts, right? What does the format look like, the structure, the decision-making, sure, all that.
Yeah, this seems to be kind of this recurrent cycle of player retires, goes into media, and then makes statements about how poor the youth system is, but has no experience in the youth system whatsoever. I mean, and I don't know specifically Landon, maybe he does have some coaching experience in the youth. I mean, but I know I've been grinding away at this for the last 14 years, doing nothing basically but coaching U13 and under. So, you know, I do feel like I have a lot better perspective than he does. The other piece of this is that those guys, they are almost the exception to the rule. So they actually went through this system and came out of it a pro to various degrees of success. Obviously, Landon Donovan, one of the best Americans ever. So, you know, I'm not sure that's the best perspective to get on the system as a whole, the extreme outlier. because they are going to have a very different experience than, you know, a lot of, you know, players who go, kind of go through this system. Like, and the other issue too is that those are the players that are given the microphone. Those are the ones that get all of the media jobs, the guys who are, you know, have gone through this system. And it is painful, because I know all of us here in this youth space, to your point, they're almost all trying to do the right thing. Like there are a couple of people not doing the right thing, a couple of bad apples. But in general, everyone's trying to do what's best for the kids. They just are so handcuffed by the system. And I don't think, outside of, you know, whenever randomly it'll come up that, oh, Don Garber said this about promotion relegation, or, oh, USL is going to go to a fake promotion relegation. It's not real promotion relegation. I don't ever hear the mainstream media talk about promotion relegation. Or I think, and I've really tried to, when I've gone on other podcasts or even talked to parents or anybody else, I try to use the term that you used as open ecosystem, because I think promotion relegation has become such a thunderbolt topic that people just automatically, you know, latch onto it and have all these strong feelings. I think open ecosystem is a lot better. But you end up having these players who have gone through a system and succeeded and been the outliers. So they think the system probably works, speaking on a system that they really don't have any real knowledge of. I heard, this was maybe 4 or 5 months ago, I don't remember when, but Tactical Manager did an interview with Hercules Gomez and asked him straight up, how come we haven't produced a top 50 player in the world ever? And his, like, he didn't even think about it. It wasn't even like a thought. He said, we don't have the coaches. Boom. And I just think that's such a cop-out. To me, it's this focusing on symptoms when the actual disease is the problem. You know, we're focusing on this little thing or that little thing, and people will jump to pay to play, and oh, it's too expensive, and yeah, that's true. But why? You know, they never go deeper. Like, oh, why is it so expensive? You know, so I do think there's always that kind of cycle of these, you know, national team members who have these huge microphones and platforms, and you know, I don't know that they're training teams 4 days a week for the last 14 years, because I have, and I've seen cycle after cycle, and a lot of these guys too, Gary, they have young kids, so their kids are 6 or 7, and it's just you have no idea if your kid is 6 or 7 what's going to happen as they go up the ladder in that system. You'd no clue. So, and I think this also gets back to what you talk about a lot, the discernment problem. Because in other countries, that would be met with pretty significant resistance from the general public. Like, they wouldn't take, like, you know, if you are in England and Harry Kane comes out and says something, he's going to get criticized if the public thinks this is bullshit. You know, like, this is nonsense. You're saying it because you're Harry Kane and, you know, you are, you know, the best striker we've ever had in our history and blah, blah, blah. But here it's just taken as like fact. It's like, oh, you know, Clint Dempsey said this, or, you know, Michael Bradley said this, or and it's not really given the same level of discernment, probably. And I guess I would imagine you would say because of the education.
Yeah, the education, and by education, I mean narrative control, right? So MLS is a monopoly, and, you know, together with US soccer, they have narrative control. They essentially control the media. The only ones who are given large platforms are the ones who are aligned with the business and objectives of the monopoly. And so they regurgitate these narratives over and over again that the youth system is the problem. The youth system is the problem. The youth system is the problem. And over the course of years and years and years and decades, everybody who hasn't been working really in the space, and even people who have been working in the space, Rory, they're like, oh yeah, the youth system is the problem. And all of the arguments supporting that the youth system is the fundamental problem are rational arguments on the surface. Pay to play. Okay, that filters out good players, you know? Yeah, that is a problem, but why is pay to play the magnitude that it is at the scale that it is? And why is that the situation here in the United States? and not elsewhere around the world. Nobody asks those deeper level questions and really start digging into it. Oh, coaching is the problem. Coaches aren't good enough. Okay, it seems like a rational explanation. If we have bad coaches, then you're not training the players correctly because you don't know how to train the players correctly. So by the time they become professionals or whatever, then they're deficient relative to their counterparts globally. And it goes on and on and on, right? Oh, the youth clubs, they're just money hungry businesses and everybody's getting rich off of children. Oh, on the surface, it seems rational. Yeah, they're charging me $3,000 or $5,000. And look at that director of coaching or that president of that club. He's driving up in an Escalade. Like, what is this? You know, so it's all very rational. And we're combating that, Rory, as best we possibly can. It's just a long slog. And it's going to take a lot of us, like you, like myself, like hopefully other independents. Tactical manager has been coming along because he used to, you know, recite these similar sorts of things, but his eyes are definitely opening up a lot more and he has a broad audience that he can help educate. And we need more people like that. I'm, you know, Eric Winalda also is very helpful. He says a lot of truths and that's why they've kind of blackballed him from holding positions in U.S. soccer or in MLS altogether. And that is what dissuades all the other former pros or national team players or people who would have influence from coming out and saying, hey, guys, look, this is actually the fundamental issue, because they won't be allowed to work anymore, Rory.
Yeah, and I think it's what you were talking about, narrative control. I don't know if you saw today Matt Crocker stepped down as sporting director of U.S. soccer. And I'm reading this article by Jeff Carlisle. I think it's Jeff Carlisle. It might have been one of the other ones. And it's just highlighting all the great things that this guy's done. And it's just, and yeah, he's done some good things, but it totally neglects, like he hired Berhalter a second time, which was clearly a big mistake. Didn't even mention it. Didn't even mention it in the article whatsoever. He had a huge plan to like reshape the geography of United States soccer. And they say, oh, it's still a big part of what's going to move forward. Well, he didn't do it. Like he had this plan, but it's just this entire, you know, rose tinted, you know, narrative of, and what's crazy is like, you know, the World Cup's in 2 months and he resigned. Like that seems kind of shocking, but no one's really, you know, like, I'm not sure other countries would be really that pleased if their sporting director resigned 2 months prior to a World Cup starting.
It's pretty strange.
Yeah, and by all accounts, he's taking a very similar role with Saudi Arabia, and good for the guy. Maybe he's getting a lot more money, but it's just, where's the criticism? Like, where is the journalist saying, what's happening with our federation that we're losing a sporting director 2 months before the World Cup? I mean, maybe it will come, but not from ESPN, not from Yahoo, not from the biggest platforms out there. And again, it's so tough because people don't understand that trickles down to their own son or daughter's soccer, experience. And so, yeah, I think that you're totally, when it comes to the narrative is just so huge.
And it's fascinating, Rory, because when things like this happen at the professional level and all eyes are on the professional level where the real issues lie, they always have a scapegoat. That the system, the way that they escape, they weasel their way out of people singling or honing into the fundamental problem, is they have fall guys. So the coaches are always the fall guy, right? The sporting director is always a fall guy. The general manager bureaucrat of a particular MLS franchise is the fall guy. You know, that's why they were terrible. The particular owner of a franchise is, oh, he just doesn't want to spend money. He's the fall guy. No, nobody looks at the system as a whole. Or the journalist in this case, who I would presume, right, given what a journalist's charter, I think, should be, is digging, right? And revealing the deeper truths.
Right. And to your point, there's only one club. There's only one governing body. There's only, so if, if, let's say, this particular reporter was critical of U.S. soccer, like he, if there wasn't just one entity, yeah, U.S. soccer might not, you know, hire him for something, but maybe USL would, or maybe MLS would, or maybe North Carolina might hire him, or the ACC, to be their soccer journalist or whatever. But you get blackballed. You get blackballed from everything, which again goes back to, you know, why the national team players would be reluctant to come out and be critical of U.S. soccer. You know, but it's easy to criticize the youth because there's no teeth. Like nothing I can do, or even if you are, you know, the president of, you know, U.S. youth soccer, you know, which you're already on the board of MLS, you're already with them anyway. But even if you are the president of some big youth soccer club, there's nothing you can really do to people criticizing you. There's no real repercussions for that. And it's an easy target and a scapegoat.
Yeah, man. Yeah. It's rough. Rory, tell us a little bit about, because I'm curious too, the tryout format. How do you go about doing this? How many times have you done it before? And yeah, lay it all out for us.
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess I've done it pretty much every year for the last 13 or 14 years. There's a couple ways to go with that question, and I get this all the time on my YouTube channel. It typically revolves around, you know, how should I get my players ready for tryouts? You know, what should I look for in a tryout if I'm a parent? And the first thing that I typically tell anybody, if they're a player or a parent, is that you need to contact the club before tryouts if you're serious, because you need to get to training session. So the players that were, you know, serious, quote unquote, about joining my MLS next team, almost all of them came to training months before we even had tryouts. Now, could you show up to a tryout and make, you know, a top team? It depends. I mean, if it's a small club and there's not a lot of competition, sure. But if you're trying to get into a big club who's got one of the big badges, you need to make yourself known to the coaches early on. And the other thing that coaches, that at least I do, I don't know what other coaches do. If I have a player who comes to my tryout, I give them their parent, a general idea where they could stand. I say, you know what, you're probably in the range of the second team, maybe fringe of the first team, or, you know, not with any type of guarantees, but just to give them some idea so they're not wasting their time. You know, and now our club doesn't charge for tryouts, but there are clubs that charge for tryouts. So, you know, and it's not typically a huge amount, but if it's $20 times thousands of kids who are coming out for tryouts, it's a nice little pocket change for them. So, you know, if I tell a player who's come out, let's say for, my training, hey, listen, you know, you're probably not, you're really going to have a chance at making, you know, the first team, and that was their goal, I've helped them out. I've answered it for them. And they basically wouldn't come to tryouts at that point. Once you get to tryouts, you know, and again, I'm just sticking with the player perspective here. I'll get to the coaching side in a minute. What I try to tell people, is that you'd be surprised at the things coaches look at. How much do you hustle? Like, how much do you, are you moving like off the ball? Off the ball is one of the biggest things I look at. I had a player come who was actually pretty good, but would pass and then would just stand still, would not move. And I knew right then and there, this guy either one hasn't been coached to this level or he's lazy. And so, you know, I mean, I sort of, you know, took the parents aside and said it as nice as I could. I said, hey, listen, he's got a lot of skill, but he hasn't been coached to move off the ball. And a lot of what we do is off the ball, if not almost everything we do is off the ball. And if he's not going to move to support after he passes, I mean, like that's just, it's a, these little tiny details that you might not pick up on. You know, I think as far as, you know, setting a tryout up, there's a little bit of theme and variation there, depending on the number of kids and the sort of size of your tryout. I can tell you one thing that parents always get upset about, but I just ran a tryout for 150 kids. There's no way, it would be a disservice to just randomly put these 150 kids into separate teams or separate sections and see what happens. So what I typically do as a coach is I will set a very loose sort of grouping of kids. So you'll have kids who are currently on the first team, kids who are currently on the second team, third, fourth, et cetera. And then at least the way that my club does it, I can see what club that player plays for and what team. So if they play for another first team, I'll kind of put them in the mix of maybe the first or second team players and so on and so forth down the line. Now, if it's a player, I have no idea who he is. Normally, I just start him at the bottom of the groups. And so I'll arrange the pennies in that particular order. And then as we start going through the different progression of activities, the coaches will recognize, oh, this person's in the wrong group. Move them up, move them down. That's typically the first 30 to 45 minutes of the first tryout, is trying to get kids just in general groups of where they could play. Now, if you have 20 kids at tryouts, you don't need to do that, obviously. We had the 2014s, which is now, because of U.S. Soccer's infinite leadership wisdom, school year for MLS 2 and lower, and birth year for MLS 1. Just another example of the chaos that, you know, the leadership has thrown the tryout coach's way. But anyway, we had probably 8 to 10 coaches, so I had a real luxury to be able to kind of group kids and move kids around. Typically, what I like to do initially, and you can set the field up as such to where I do like to get some form of a passing pattern to start. So I want to see how you can trap and move a ball, and again, how you move off the ball. And it can be a Dutch diamond. It can be something very, very simple that, again, because if you have 150 kids, you know, it's got to be very simple to set up and then and take down. The way that I ran this particular tryout is we had Dutch diamonds, and then the way that it was set up is that could easily go into 1v1s within that particular group. So each group had, let's say, 10 kids in it. And so they would do Dutch diamonds for a little while. That would transition to 1v1s. That could easily transition to 2v1s. So now you see, okay, what do you do with an overload? And then how do you do defensively when you're underloaded? That then typically would progress to it'd be easier. Maybe I'll send you the diagram. It'd be easier to see the diagram for coaches. That would progress very easily into a 5v5 four goal game, based on the two Dutch diamonds that you have set up. And then from there, I would have liked to play maybe 11v11, but I ended up playing 9v9 with teams. And then I only had four fields. So with 150 kids, I played four 9v9 sort of setups. And then we set up small sided games along the edges. So they were playing 2v2, 3v3. So you got to see them on a smaller field. What do they do in tight spaces? And then what do they do in larger spaces? And, you know, that pretty much was repeated the second day. We had 2 days of tryouts. And the second day of tryout, again, you're just kind of manipulating players to be moved along. And every year it happens, Gary, we get parents who are just livid that their kid didn't get a chance to play with the top players. And my response to them is always, listen, they got a chance. They just didn't shine in the group they were in. If they did, they would have moved up. And it's funny to me too, because you have parents who complain that their kid who is on the fourth team all year didn't get a chance to play with the top team. And it's like, well, listen, if he was good enough all year, they would have sent him to my practices. Like the tryouts in general are you're polishing. Like you have a general idea of what's happening. And then it's like, okay, what are we going to do? Or now again, we did get two kids who came out of nowhere who ended up making actually the second team. But so that can happen. It's just so much less likely. And what you're doing as a coach, or what you should be doing as a coach, is preparing quite a bit before the tryout, getting all the players in general, not locked in by any means, but you're saying, okay, like for example, my MLS, you know, one team, there were 5 or 6 kids that, barring some miracle, were probably going to make that team, the 5 to 6 best kids in the club. You then had a group of, I don't know, 15 kids for the next 10 spots. And it's like, okay, I know kind of where you stand. I know positionally where you might be. I know, you know, again, you're left footed, you're this, like you're just making these small decisions and then evaluating any new player that were to come. I think where coaches get into a lot of trouble is they say, oh, this is going to be a clean slate for me. And we're just going to, you know, put all the kids randomly out there. And it does no good for a kid on the fourth team or fifth team to be playing with kids on the first team, because he's going to get destroyed, and it's going to kill his confidence. It's not going to help you evaluate either of those kids, either the fourth team kid or the first team kid. So as long as you are preparing in general for it, and then you've got a way of transitioning, especially with the very large group, So that's in general, that's at least how I did it this year. But I do try, I know some of the clubs just, they just play. And I think that that does a disservice to kids who are really good in tight spaces, because you might not even see that happen. It doesn't necessarily, you know, in many respects, unless you're focusing on one kid, show how do they move off the ball. That can be a lot harder in a big 11v11 game versus a passing pattern where you can see, did the player, you know, lose their man? Did they go one way versus the other? Did they receive across their body? Whereas in a game, you know, you might not even get an opportunity to see it. Plus, again, when you have 150 some odd kids. So hopefully that would help some people who are kind of thinking through that process.
No, I love it. I absolutely love it. Just to be clear, it was 2 days or 3 days worth of?
2 days, two hour and a half sessions. Yeah.
Got it. Do you feel as a practitioner that that is sufficient time for you to kind of discern? And we all get it wrong. You know, we all get it wrong. Edge cases all over the place and stuff for sure. But generally speaking, is 2 days, 2 hour sessions each day kind of enough to kind of say, you know what, I kind of have a handle on the talent?
The only reason I would say yes is because of what I just mentioned, is because I have so many ducks in a row prior to that. It's really just making a few decisions here or there. The biggest help to coaches is, and again, I always tell players, is to get to training sessions months before a tryout, if you're really serious about joining a team. Because, you know, a lot of the players who came into our club, I had seen 5, 6, 7 times in training sessions with me. And, you know, I know that there's this whole kind of narrative out there about recruiting. Oh, you can't recruit. You know, you can't invite other players from other clubs to your sessions. And I'm not actively reaching out, but when people reach out to me or to the club, I have no, you know, I let them come to training, and then I give them a general idea of where I think their kid may or may not stand. And I just don't think that there's any issues with that. So 2 days. So I guess the other way of answering that is not to speak on both sides of my mouth here, is to say no. And the fact that, to your point, in 6 months, I guarantee you I have made a mistake. Like, I guarantee, because it happens every single year. It happened this year where kids on the second team, the last two or three who make it, they develop and they ascend. And now they're better than my last two or three kids on the first team. And so, you know, ideally, I would like to have tryouts June 1st. I wish U.S. Soccer and, you know, MLS and the governing bodies within the youth game would say, okay, enough of this chaos, enough of this nonsense. We're going to finish out. Because here's the other part of this, Gary. I have to now train and play with teams who have players who are moving down to either the first team, the second team, the second team, the third team for 2 months. And just, you know, forget me and forget, you know, any type of, you know, hard feelings I might have or how much I care about the kids. What about that kid? Who knows? He is, you know, one of two or three kids who will not be on that team anymore. I mean, that is just such, it's not fair, in my opinion, to that kid. And, you know, what happens if that kid in 2 or 3 months actually developed and, you know, got to a place where he's now maybe on that team? I'll have no way of knowing that. And that's directly because of youth soccer or U.S. soccer. It's directly because of them. And the parents think it's the club and the big bad club, and they're making decisions, and it's just not, as we previously talked about. So in that respect, it isn't enough time. But I'm a prisoner to the system that I live in, I guess.
No, yeah, for sure. And would you say, I don't want to put words in your mouth, it's just came to my mind, without that preparation that you mentioned for the tryouts, having kids come earlier, you know, months, and you already kind of have an idea, a feel. If you don't do that, and if you don't have a plan for those specific tryout dates, my mind went to, you're probably going to get a little confused as to who the better players are, because you might be more impressed by the more athletic players because it's the easiest thing to see.
100%. And I see that all the time with coaches. If you're not prepared to run a session, and then again, it's a little, like I mentioned before, a little bit numbers dependent, but a lot of these tryouts have huge numbers of kids. And if you're not ready at least with some semblance of a plan, some semblance of where most of these kids would be ranked. And look, if a kid surprises you, great. They bump up. And another tool in the toolbox is, let's say you have a kid who looked really good at tryouts, a kid maybe you don't know that well, and you say, hey, listen, between the first and the second tryout or after the second tryout, could you come to a training session? And then you see, okay, I'm going to put you through 2 hours with the top team, and we're going to do rondos. We're going to do positional games. We're going to do stuff that, quite frankly, you just can't do with 150 kids. I can't set up 50 4v1 rondos. I can't do it. Like, it's not plausible. So if you have a kid who is, again, even on the borderline or whatever, you say, hey, come out to a training session, because that's the other thing too. Like for example, last week we had tryouts on Monday and Wednesday. I lost my training session for Monday and Wednesday because I had to run tryouts. So I'm trying to get ready for these state cup huge games on the weekend, and I lose 2 out of my 3 training sessions. So it just, you know, it just compounds the job that us as coaches have to do with the current team.
Yeah, no, totally. I have a couple more questions for you here on this note. So when you're going to make decisions, and you said you had like 8 to 10 assistants because you have a huge pool of players to assess, do you guys have any sort of standardized sheet of paper, whatever, that you probably came up with the names of the players or something, and all your coaches are kind of like ranking the players a little bit? How does that filtering happen? Is it a scale of 1 to 10, 1 to 5? Do you not do any numerical things? What are the categories that you kind of broken up the assessment in? And then after that, do the parents kind of get this assessment, or do you kind of give them some sort of synopsis if they come and ask you? So basically ranking of players for final decision-making.
Yeah. And I guess I should have mentioned this a little bit beforehand, because I also do a couple of other things. So we actually had a pre-tryout meeting with all of the coaches, and where we actually went down with the current club players and put general ranks on them. So 1 first team, 2 second team, 1.5 in between the first team and the second team, even 1.75 closer to the second team than the first team, and so on and forth, so forth, all the way down to 6, because we have 6 teams in the age group currently. We at our club have a little bit of a luxury, as we use an app called Playmetrics. So the coaches put, you know, as they are evaluating, they put their numbers in, and then that particular app will calculate it. And you can do all sorts of stuff where you can rank players from 1 to 6. You can you put them in a spreadsheet. You can do all sorts of stuff. And I guess I should clarify, like, I didn't have 8 assistants. There's like me and my assistant for the first team, the second team coach, and their assistant for the second team. And so all these guys basically are coaching at some level within the club. And so what we tried to do, which again, the parents don't like, is put the kids, for example, who are kind of in that third team, fourth team category, on the field with the third team and the fourth team coach. And so if they see a kid who's, hey, this kid's probably better than fourth team, he sends that kid over to the third team field, and so on and so forth. So you get this matriculation that logically makes sense. And, you know, the parents a lot of times feel like you're playing favorites. To your point, if I did this randomly, and I've been at tryouts that I didn't run where I saw this, you get kids who are just running past fourth team kids because they're fourth team kids. And yeah, they can tap a ball and take a huge touch and run right past them because that player is not going to make them pay. But you go up against the first team center back, they're going to take the ball from you 10 out of 10 times if you try that. So, you know, you don't really get a fair evaluation unless you're putting them up against like for like type players. And you can say, okay, now I can make some final determinations.
No, brilliant. The other thing I had written down here is something that the general public at large and the media, everybody in the ecosystem always talks about. It's like, oh, Gary, you don't know when a kid is 11, you know, whether he has what it takes to be a pro or something like this from a technical perspective, whatever, okay? But I want to use that for framing the following. At what age would you say, Rory, is it okay to have tryouts, right? Because some folks will say, oh, for 8-year-olds or 10-year-olds, like, that's just, it's just not right. You know, you're picking the winners and losers, and then people get on a virtuous cycle. Like if you deem this group of players as the first team players, then they're in this virtuous cycle. Then they're always first team players. And while the other guy could have been maybe, you know, mature into a first team player, you're ruining his projection by doing the trial and filtering them down to the second team or the third team. I think you mentioned this particular tryout of yours was U12 to U13. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, we're current U12 going to U13.
Got it. So people, I think, have maybe less of an issue at that age, and certainly at the higher ages, even lesser of an issue, right? If you're doing tryouts for 15-year-olds or something like so. But maybe you can speak a little bit to that common dart that is thrown coaches and clubs' ways.
Yeah, two things I thought of, and I don't want to go down too deep of a rabbit hole, but it gets back to what we've already talked about, is the system is set up like this. And one thing that I've noticed through my, 13, 14 years doing this is when I started, there was no such thing as a U8 travel team, at least not that I recall. U8 was still rec. U8 was, you didn't really start until U9. And then maybe 7 or 8 years ago, you started seeing these pre-travel teams. So now you're dealing with 8-year-olds who are pre-travel. And now you're even getting some U7 pre-travel teams. And this is all a consequence of the system and the fact that clubs, again, not to their fault whatsoever, are in the business of customer retention. And so if you can grab a kid at 7 as a travel player, they're much more likely to stay with you when they're 14 versus if you wait till 10 or 12 or whatever it is. Rory O'Neill thinks would be this, altruistic time to have tryouts really doesn't make much of a difference in this current system that we have. The other thing that kind of came to my mind is, and I'd be interested actually to get your take on this, because I don't know if I know that this is an advantage to U.S. soccer. They just do this. The formats that we use are fairly larger than the majority of the world as we start in youth sports or youth soccer, excuse me. So in the vast majority of European nations, they play 4v4 almost to age 10, maybe age 9. They then move to 7v7. For example, in Spain, they play 7v7 pretty much to U13, U14, and then they go to 11v11. They're really looking at long-term development. They're saying, okay, smaller sided means more touches, means more technical opportunities, means more likely better development. It's something called Faninho, which was developed by a German actually for Spain. Germany rejected his program for years and then they finally adopted it. But it just, all of this just continues to push us in a direction of the system's completely broken. And so, those things, and in an ideal world, I wouldn't necessarily have tryouts maybe, or I would at least play smaller formats for a long period of time. But all these clubs and coaches are operating in this broken system. And so those are the things that kind of came to my mind when you're saying, when should we have tryouts? It's like, well, we don't have a choice.
Yeah, no, 100%, Corey. Okay, I have a good feel for the tryout program that you have there. I don't know where you want to take the discussion next. My mind keeps going back to our little text exchange about Jimmy Oblida's episode, because I know Jimmy's a very impassioned, long-time coach, seasoned at all the possible levels, and he was a very good coach, and is a very good coach in my opinion. And his opinions are very hardcore, being Uruguayan and, us being Argentines over here. He thinks winning is important, an important component to things. And a lot of people disagree, and some people do agree. So I don't know if you want to discuss a little bit about winning versus development, how you see that.
No, definitely. This is always something that seems to come around. And I look at this as somewhat of a logical fallacy. I mean, you have no way of proving falsehood, no matter what anybody says on this. And, it becomes like a slippery slope that we talk about where you say, well, if you're only focused on winning, there's no such thing, you're not worried about development. And if you only, if I'm a coach and I'm only worried about development, winning doesn't matter, right? And I think that you end up going down this path of really context and level. And so depending on who is speaking, what perspective they have, really dictates where it goes. And very similar to what we were just talking about, because we don't necessarily have discernment among the masses, they just take whatever that person is saying, whether it be, you know, factual or not, and they run with that particular tangent. So I think that one of the things, you know, that Jimmy's sort of perspective brings up in the youth space, and that's really where I always go to because it's what I live every day to day, is we just see so many coaches who just take the easy route, who, you know, don't, you know, build out of the back, who really don't take the time to teach the small details, who favor that player who is big and strong and fast, and don't really give the same amount of credence to the technical player, all in this, you know, semblance of winning, you know, like one of the examples that I can share with you, is that I have seen coaches at the MLS next level. And I know you got in a lot of trouble a few months ago when you said it's all rec, right? Like MLS next, it's all rec. Well, I agree with a lot of what you're saying. And so if you have a player who's MLS next and you drive, and a parent's paying thousands of dollars for this, right? And you drive 3 hours to a game and that player plays 4 minutes. Like what are we doing here? You know, are we so concerned about winning a U14 game that we allow a 15-year-old kid who's not going to be a pro? Let's just be honest here. None of these kids are going to be pros, to play 4 minutes because you wanted to win, you know, a game in the MLS next group, which doesn't really mean anything. You know, like I think that for me, that particular example kind of highlights the idea of winning versus development. It's like, I definitely want to win. There's no question, but I'm not going to do to a 15-year-old psyche. And, you know, in the system that we live, I wouldn't do that. Now, would I play them 20 minutes of a 90 game? Sure. Like, I've seen players go to these MLS next games on rosters and see zero game time, zero. Which, again, like, why are they on the team then? You know, like it's the coach's ego is so inflated that their entire being depends on winning a game that, quite frankly, doesn't matter. Like it matters in a sense that you're trying to win games, sure. But there's also a component, and maybe I'm on a high horse here, of what we're doing, because most of these kids are going to take the skills that you teach them in soccer and apply it to something else. They're not going to play professionally. You know what I mean? And so I agree that winning is extremely important, but I think that it's all based on the frame and the context and the level. And you know, you might say to me, Gary, well, if the coach had that conversation with the parents, say, hey, listen, you might go to the game and not play, that's a completely different situation. I'm just bringing some of that up because I think some of the coaches at the youth level, and that was an example at the very high level. This could be U9. This could be U9, where they're screaming and yelling and joysticking players and telling them to kick the ball long and don't play it in the middle and all this nonsense, purely to win a game. Unfortunately, in our space, we see it all the time. And so that's kind of where my head goes a little bit on it. Per our normal conversations, I didn't really have anything planned as far as what I was going to get into. But when I heard about, or when I listened to the podcast with Jimmy and then the follow-up with Benny, a lot of the what I see in the youth game kind of came to my head.
Got it. Yeah, I agree with you. And I also have seen the youth coach, quote-unquote, like egomaniacs that fit the framing that you just laid out. I always try to protect the coaches in general, right? Because people will take those situations and then generalize it to all of youth soccer and all of the coaches, you know, and any coach who wants to win, even if the kid does play 20 minutes, right? Or half a game or whatever the case may be, they'll generalize, oh, all the youth coaches are egomaniacs. All they care about is winning. And I want to inject this other truth that also exists, which is, hey, look, they're not egomaniacs. They are thinking about development, even of those players on the lower end of the roster. They do care. Let's just give them some grace in the fact that they may have already spoken to the parents and the player at the beginning of the season around what the circumstances are. Like even in tryouts, you might be like, hey, listen, parent, you can go on the first team, but I'm telling you right now that you probably should be on the second team. On the second team, you're going to play 90 minutes or something. You go to the first team, I can't guarantee anything. So if you have that conversation, right, and then some random comes by the field and sees that this player didn't even play or played 10 minutes, then they say, ah, that coach, see, he's part of the problem, right, without understanding what led them to making those sorts of decisions. The other thing leads back to the incentives in the system. The incentives in the system are you need to win games. And it's not just from the club's pressure that is barreling down on you that you need to win games, but from the parents, right? The parents of the best players on the team want you to win the game. And if you see that you put little Johnny on, you know, for half of the match, and then you lose the game, then guess what's going to happen? The better players and the families on that team are going to start thinking, say, you know what? We need to leave this. We got to go, right? And how you mentioned, it's all about customer retention here. So you're kind of doing a huge disservice to your employer. You're doing a huge disservice, in my opinion, to yourself also, because if they leave, you're in shambles. The team is in shambles. The rest of the players are in shambles. The rest of the families are in shambles. You can't continue your development work as a coach, right? Because you're in shambles now. The better players left you. Chaos has ensued. And you just have this cascade effect, right, Rory? If you don't win a threshold number of games, right? Or if you are competing at the very top where you're one of the top five teams in the state or in the region or whatever, the better players want to be on the championship team. It doesn't matter that you came in second or in third. They will still leave you for the championship team next season. So all of these pressures are woo-woo in the coach's mind. I agree with you. There are egomaniacs. I've seen it at the U9 level. They're screaming, going bananas on the sideline. And we can attribute, you know, the non-development tag to them. But I don't know. It's just a pet peeve of mine, because this gives ammunition to the Landon Donovans, to the Don Garbers, to the powers that be, to perpetuate and have more narrative control.
Yeah, and it all really goes back to incentives that you said. I mean, if, you know, the coach is incentivized to develop players for their first team, that they're going to be thinking dramatically differently than, to your point, you know, especially when you get to the higher levels, when you get into MLS Next and ECNL, the winning becomes important for customer retention. It also becomes, you know, this badge that, you know, you're a good coach, which,
right,
you know, maybe you are, maybe you're not. That's completely, you know, the discernment problem again, because you can certainly win many games and not be a very good coach, and vice versa. So it's like, how does a coach balance it? You know, how does a coach balance that? And I don't know that I even have the right answers for it, other than, you know, it's very, that's what I was saying before, whenever you're talking about this winning versus development sort of argument, it's so dependent on the specific situation and the specific context and the specific level of that person who has the microphone.
Yeah. Yeah. And it happens outside of soccer. It just does. You know, I've been teaching for better part of 15, 20 years now, and I teach different courses, and in my different courses, you have a bell curve of students, right? You have the exceptional ones, and it runs the gamut. And so as an instructor, how are you supposed to teach, right? Do you teach to the top end? Do you teach to the middle end? Do you teach to the bottom end? Because you can't be everything to everybody, and you can't make everybody happy. who just can't. If you teach to the top end, or in soccer, if you coach to the top end, you have the bottom end of the roster. Those families are very upset, right? Because you're not catering to their kid. The same thing happens as an employer. The same thing happens everywhere. It's not unique to us.
I'm curious about this. So when I was an undergrad I went to University of Michigan, I took a physical chemistry class, and it was notorious for being pretty much the hardest course on campus, or one of the hardest courses on campus. And I finished with a 3.5 in the class. My percentage in that class was 33%, because it was all graded on a curve. And I'm curious to know, to come from the educational background that you have, like, how much would I have really learned and gained from a class where I only got 33% out of 100 for the entire semester, yet it was one of the better grades in the class, which means there were kids who probably got 2.0s who were in the 10, 15%. Like, how do you balance that out?
It's difficult. I think it also context dependent. It depends on the course, and it depends on the professor, and it depends on the institution, because I'll tell you, from my personal experience, when I was an undergrad in graduate school, it felt like the standards were exceptionally high. And I too, you know, my courses too were in chemistry and physics and mathematics. You know, there was a curve for sure. It was not straight scale, 90, 80, 70. Like, that's getting a 90% on these sorts of things is goddamn well impossible. There's just too much. Yeah. It's too difficult. But it seems like the standards have been degrading and lowering the bar over the years, to the point where we're at now. The bar is outrageously low, and there's unstated incentives for professors to just like pass everybody. Okay. Just like, don't, like, you can fail people, but if you fail a little bit too many, you know, eyebrows go up, and, you know, students complain a lot more these days. And all of a sudden you have an issue on your hands, right? So you've been lowering the bar, lowering the bar, lowering the bar, and everything's been nerfed, Rory. Everything has been nerfed. You can't teach to the top end. I don't know what it's like at institutions like MIT or Princeton or Caltech or Harvard, even though Harvard's been in the news for, you know, doing this sort of soft ass education, if you can call it that. It's just a societal issue at this point, Rory, and it's seeped into our soccer.
Well, I was literally just going to ask, do you think that there are parallels to US youth soccer?
Totally. And you heard it in the Jimmy episode. When we were coaching youth soccer, when we started, whenever it was, 20 years ago or 25 years ago, whenever, you as a coach can be a lot more strict and stern and quote unquote authoritarian, disciplinarian, speak the truth, you know, tell it how it is. And now you have to put a veneer on it all. You have to soften everything. You have to have all these extended conversations with the parents, you know, and massage them and not tell them the full truth and nothing but the truth. You don't lie to them, but you don't say, hey, look, it's just not going to happen for Johnny. No, you have to say, look, right now, here's where he's at, but, you know, maybe giving him some time, 6 months, a year, anything can happen. It's exhausting. And I don't blame coaches who abandon ship after, I don't know. When do you think, because now you have all this experience and I'm sure you see young coaches, Rory, when do you think that these new coaches start getting a little bit jaded and start giving up, right? They come in bright-eyed, bushy-tailed. They want to do the best job in the world. They want to be amazing. And then they get beaten into submission one way or another.
Yeah, boy, have I seen that. I think one of the biggest problems is there really are not a lot of mentors out there for people starting out. You know, you're almost just put on your own. You say, you know, with a club, we'll say, hey, here's your team. Good luck. You know, most clubs don't even have a lesson plan or a season plan, depending on the age, depending on the level. Because a lot of the coaches come in and they're, most of them, former players. And as we talked about in this episode, that means, I don't want to say nothing, but it means very little, in my opinion. They're just two completely different things. I don't remember which episode it was. I think you said it's like being a student and a teacher. Just because you are a good student doesn't mean you have any business teaching the subject matter. And yeah. I think that often happens, which is funny because the let's say higher level that parents think you've played, the more credibility and leeway I think they typically give people. Whereas, you know, I haven't played to any level that would be noteworthy. And, you know, I have the YouTube channel helps now quite a bit. But I mean, before, parents would be like, who are you? Where did you play? Like, you know, did you play professionally? Did you play in college? Like, no. But as far as, you know, the young coaches go, you know, it's tough, because what I have seen with most of the guys that I've at least worked with, is they come out very ambitious. And, you know, I've had a few friends who have gone on to coach at MLS clubs. And they're there for maybe a year, maybe 2 years, maybe three, but the pay is not very good. The hours are really, really long. Sometimes the human resource element of it, they're not treated very well. And then they have to make a decision because, you know, coaches don't necessarily make livable wages. And most of the time they don't. So they, oftentimes what happens is about 26, 27 is when I see guys who maybe started when they were 22, 23, and they say, all right, now I got to figure out, can I actually coach full time and find a situation where that'll work for me? Or do I have to go back to grad school or find a real job and coach a little bit part-time on the side? And a lot of the things you're describing, the headaches in youth soccer, the chaos of the system, it just pushes them out because they're like, you know what, F this. I'm just going to, you know, go finish up my degree or go work for FedEx or whatever. And yeah, I can still coach, but then they don't put as much time and effort into it. You know, they're like, I'm coaching, you know, but I got my other job over here and, you know, I'm not going to deal with the parents. I'm not going to do this. You know, I'm just going to take it easy. And, so that's a pattern that I've seen coaches go down quite a bit. And, you know, that there's not a great pathway for young coaches to become directors or to, you know, get into some really, you know, situation where they're at least making a livable wage. I don't think anybody who coaches is naive enough to think that they're going to be, you know, making tons of money. But you know, like at least around my area, let's say you pay a coach, I don't know, $5,000 a team would be a number that I've seen before. So they have three teams. You're not going to have much more than three teams. So they make $15,000. Like that's not a livable wage whatsoever. So they have to find something else to do. Well, how are you going to coach three different teams and have a full-time job? It's just not possible. So I would say that's the path I see young coaches go down quite a bit.
For the audience sake, I can put this in the intro anyway, but where are you coaching, Rory?
Sure.
Location wise.
I coach in central Pennsylvania. It's a MLS club called Keystone FC. I've been there now three or four years. I've coached all over the place, in the central Pennsylvania area. And then I coached for 3 years, at the Philadelphia Union's youth, programs. So I have some good understanding of what MLS clubs do.
Why do you keep doing it, man?
Wow. That's a great question. The one team that I currently, that I'm going to MLS next with, my youngest son is on that team. And so I think, you know, and I don't know if we've had that, I've shared this story before, but, I was not coaching him originally. And I was coaching another team, and it was actually the second team at his age group. And he was on the first team, and the director asked me to step in and coach the first team, just cause he had a lot of things going on. And so I took that team over, and, it's now given me an opportunity because I always wanted to coach at the highest level in the youth game. When I was getting my D license, they make you put goals. And one of my goals was I want to coach. This was 2018. I was like, I want to coach in the development academy at the time. And this will now be starting next year, kind of reaching that goal, is I'm going to be coaching MLS next, which I've never done before. So there's that piece of it, but there's also the piece of it's me and my son and that group of guys that I've kind of started with. So, that's part of it. But the other part in the team that I've had before, the teams that I've had that where my son's not on it, is it's for the players, for the kids. I mean, I don't know. I get something really out of seeing them develop. I don't know how to describe it. I think every coach, that's why you do it, is that, it, you know, there's a huge personal satisfaction that comes with the huge responsibility of being sort of a mentor to these kids. And, you know, I grew up playing mostly baseball, and I think maybe I've shared this before. I mean, I think baseball is the reason I got into medical school. Like, I think that, you know, the lessons that I learned, and just, you know, to your point, I think, you know, and I know that generations always say this, but I feel like this generation is especially soft. And so how do you deal with adversity? Well, a lot of the players that I have, they're not going to have a lot of like economical adversities in their life. So how do you teach people how to deal with adversity if they're not necessarily having a ton of adversity in their regular life? They go to a good school, they have a nice family, a nice house, you know, well, through sport, in my opinion. So I would say that's why I do it, is just that I love the interactions with the kids and to see them grow. And you're almost kind of dealing with, you know, certain parents and then just the chaotic system in spite of that love of those players.
Got it. I want to make one remark before I forget and also give you the final word or the final topic or whatever. Going back to the tryouts, you mentioned something very important, which is the body language of the player is something that you guys are looking at. And that's a reflection of their inner dialogue and their mentality and these sorts of things, which is connected to what you just said, right? The softness and that stuff. It happens at every level. So we facilitated tryouts in the past for European teams. Okay. And we have sent very talented players to be seen by European clubs. And they're very good, right? Because if they're going to take on a foreigner, they're looking at absolutely everything. You are truly under the microscope, and they don't have 1,000 kids that they're trying to assess. So it is a different assessment sort of thing that they're doing. And it just brings me to this memory of this one particular player who we took to a Champions League club, and he was invited to. Okay. And we said, absolutely. Of course you can see him. We're going. And the final assessment was, Gary, he'd be the best player that we have in the academy by far. But body language, posture, in every, and kind of almost like every sort of facet, it's just not, we're not sure, you know, and which is basically a nice way of saying no thanks. And literally, and I believe the guy because I saw it with my own eyes. I like to think that I have a level of discernment for the talent itself, right? The technique, the soccer IQ, the athleticism, all this stuff. Rory, by far the best player that they would have in their institution, you know, aside from the first team players. But they're looking for first team players, right? Is this player going to be an asset to us on the first team? Yes or no? So that's how much weight the body language carries.
Oh, I believe it. I mean, I know that I'll look at, you know, again, if it's between one or two spots and there's three or four guys, I mean, I want to see what happens after you make a mistake. Like, I'm not so worried about a bad touch or something, you know, that happens. I want to see what the response is to that. You know, even simple stuff like, you know, we send you to go get water. Are you running? And then do you run back? Like, you know, how enthusiastic, you know, when I say, okay, let me get these five guys over there. Do you go run over there? Or do you just, you know, even something crazy, like, so we'll end the tryout, you know, and this happens every time. I'll get a couple of kids to say, hey coach, can I help you pick up? And like, I'm like, okay, someone has taught them responsibility. Somebody has said, yes. Hey, you know, this is not, you know, you're not privileged to be here. You're here. You know, it's an honor, like help them pick up. You know, I have kids at practice who will just leave right away. And I have some kids who will stay the entire time and pick up all the balls, pick up all the cones. And I don't say anything. I don't mandate, you know, you got to help me clean up. You got to help me. You know, I have kids who come up to me every practice. These are kids who've been with me for years. Say, thank you, coach, every practice. So somebody has got a bug in their ear to have said, listen, you know, this is important. And this is, you know, an honor to be here. Like, this is how you act. And it goes a long way. It really does.
No, and it goes a long way, I think, for them as an adult later in life. They're internalizing who they are, right? Because, I mean, after you do this for such a long period of time, you can tell whether a player has internalized these sorts of things, coming early, leaving late, volunteering, pick up the balls and the nets and all this sort of stuff, versus they were told to do it and they're just doing it out of an obligation, right? You can tell when a player comes up and shakes your hand, thank you, coach, when they're going to leave for the day, versus somebody told them to do it.
Yeah. Oh yeah. 100%. And then it's the same thing with just little stuff. Like, are they talking about stuff outside of soccer while we're actually running training? Are they talking about school? You know, do they get out of their car and walk to the field, like at the time training starts with no cleats on? If they're late, are they running to the field? Because I mean, the ages that I coach, obviously they can't drive. So that's, you know, getting to the field on time is not 100%, you know, 100% up to them. But when they get out of the car, are they sprinting, cleats on, or are they walking, you know, with tennis shoes or Crocs on? It's just the little tiny things like that. And when you're trying to make, you know, very difficult decisions, now what you described was at the highest level, but even at a high level team in the American youth landscape, these little details can be big.
Yeah, no, it matters, man. Anything that we didn't cover that you wanted to touch, Rory, or anything that came to mind?
No, I think we got it all. I mean, I know we talked a lot about tryouts, and I initially didn't message you about that, but it's so fresh in my mind, and so fresh in kind of what we're doing here in the youth space, and maybe you guys have never actually talked about this on the podcast before. So I'm hoping that it'll help some people. Because it can be such a landmine.
No, it's very helpful to me as well. I'm certainly going to ask Benny to clip a lot of these lessons learned that you've captured for us and all this insight. I think it's helpful for both parents and for coaches. And frankly, I know we have a lot of reporters and media that also tune in from time to time. I hope they take it more to heart as to the struggles that, you know, those of you in the trenches have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. And then a lot of it doesn't come to you. A lot of it is not up to you. Right. You have to do these sorts of things the way that they're being told to do.
Yeah, no, I just think overall, I would just hope that parents in particular could see that the clubs and the coaches are a very small part of this machine and that we have almost no control over it. And, you know, the people who do have all the control over it don't take any of the responsibility for it. And they're not the ones having these, in many cases, heartbreaking conversations with people. You know, they're not the ones. And we are the ones who are doing it. And it's the system is so flawed. That's why things like tryouts happen the way that they happen. And I don't know that there's a large percentage of parents who understand that. I think that most people, are fed the, you know, the constant real stuff, either as we talked about before, the former players or the mainstream journalists, you know, reveal. And they, like, I don't think there's going to be a story on ESPN about how tryouts are completely destroyed because of the system that we're in. I don't think that's coming.
Yeah. Tell people where they can find you, Rory. I know you're wildly popular on YouTube.
Yeah. It's just Coach Rory Soccer on YouTube. And I get emails all the time, all week from all across the world. So, you know, if anybody wants my email, I respond to emails pretty quickly. It's all on that webpage, and the YouTube channel is really just for, it's mostly a coaching, site. I mean, there's some opinion stuff on there, but if you're looking for content like the stuff we've discussed, I'm not sure there's a ton of it on my YouTube page. There's some, but most of it is how I would go about coaching in the youth game.
And I think, but beyond coaches, I think parents derive great value from seeing a practitioner talk about the craft itself.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think that is the one thing that I think, and I know, I think we've touched on this before, but parents are very receptive to data and to information when it involves their own child. And I think that is really maybe the straw that will eventually break the camel's back for this system, is if the parents all galvanize and sort of get educated and this discernment problem that you always talk about, that's really what has to be the domino that falls, because, you know, the clubs really can't do anything about it, you know, as much as they might like to. It's the overwhelming majority of the country and the parents are going to have to say enough is enough and we need an open ecosystem.
Yeah, and the economy is the economy. It's not like U.S. Soccer or MLS can decree for all the youth clubs to operate a certain way. They can't do that. Not only is it illegal, but you cannot function as a business in a manner that is different than what it is right now. At least I don't see a solution to that. You have to make revenue. You have to generate revenue. Nobody's just going to gift you money.
Yeah, and it's very expensive to run a club. So it's, you know, the clubs, I think the club I'm at is doing a lot of good things. I think there's a lot of clubs out there that do a lot of good things that try to help parents and players as much as they can. But there's a ceiling to all of that.
Yeah.
You know, they have no way of breaking through that ceiling with other forms of revenue right now. So that's again, the open ecosystem issue.
All right, brother. Hey, thank you again for coming on. I know our audience, I get a lot of emails from coaches in particular that say, hey, Rory sent me your way, you know? So I thank you for that in a very big way. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, man, let's do it again. I always like having a chat.
Oh, and I want a freaking asado one of these days. It looked
pretty
good.
Oh, dude, if you're in the greater Philadelphia area, I'm about an hour and a half from Philly, so maybe hour and a half, 2 hours. So open invitation. Yeah, anytime.
Brilliant. If anybody's wondering why Rory's such a great coach, okay, and great orator and everything that's great about Rory, his wife's Argentinian. There you go.
100%. That is the reason. There's no doubt. She would say, for sure.
All right, brother. Have a good one, man. Amen. I'll let you know when this is going up.
Perfect. Yeah, I'll post it as well on my YouTube channel.
Thanks, Rory. Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches, you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers, everyone, and keep building.